Let's go ahead and get started. We're starting a little late because I don't have a quorum. Chairman York is out of the country, and I have the other two committee members on their way, and one should be here shortly. I'm going to start. I can't do the consent agenda at this point, and the only item I can really take up is one informational item. That's item number four. So let me welcome everybody to the November 19, 2014 Finance, Government Services and Operations Committee. And we will move to the information item number four, quarterly report, budget first quarter, FY2015 financial update and cash proffer report for information. If I do not have a quorum at the end of this item, I'll recess the meeting until we do. Thank you. Welcome. Would you like to add to our report tonight?
Hi, I'm Megan Burke with the Budget Office. Mm-hmm. So we'd just like to present you our first quarter report based on the first quarter actuals and some trend analysis and other assumptions. We're projecting budget authority in excess of $16.2 million, a shortfall in revenues of $2.6 million, which gives us a net $13.5 million to the good. I can go into a little bit more detail about revenues and expenditures, or I can just start with your questions.
Okay, well, right now we're projecting revenues to be about $2.6 million under the revised budget, expenditures, a variance of about $16.2 to the good.
Yes.
So the net is about $13.5 million we're projecting by the end of fiscal 15.
That's correct.
And the one item that I saw that appears to be running very positive appears to be the general property taxes.
Yes.
And some of that looks to be due to, and help me out here, but some of it looks to be personal property associated with data centers, that is really upticking for us at this time.
Yeah, based on computer equipment as well as furniture and fixtures.
Yeah, the personal property tax revenue on computer equipment has grown by more than 20% in each of the last two fiscal years. And we, in the FY15 budget, we did not assume that rate of growth. It was more on the order of like 10%, but it's coming in stronger than we had anticipated.
And most of that's data centers?
Most of that's data centers.
Okay, great. Well, I'd rather we were conservative and have a positive result. The only other question I've got on this item, on fines and forfeitures, projected to be $2.1 million below the revised budget. There's a note here that says most of this variance is due to an inadvertent overstatement of projected fines and forfeiture revenue in the budget. Can you just explain that at least?
Yeah, and I'm the guilty party on that. When the fines and forfeiture revenue is entered into the system through the cost center, I inadvertently entered it as a non-departmental revenue item. So it actually got entered twice, and we didn't catch it in time to correct it in the adopted budget. But that was the cause.
Okay. Hospitality industry, it looks like room revenue is up, but it looks like a lot of that TOT is going to, it says due to a new property, I'm assuming that's Salamander and it's going to Middleburg. Is that correct? You have to do more shake your head.
Yeah. During the summer, the hotel industry in the county did quite well. Activity was up. A good chunk of that was due to Salamander, but not exclusively that. The first quarter TOT revenue was up about 10% versus a year ago. Now, we don't look for that rate of increase for the entire year because the revenue tends to be pretty volatile. You can have one real good quarter, and it can be followed by a bad quarter.
Okay. That's all I have.
Yeah, I could ahead. Add one. We did get information from the state last week about the potential revenue shortfall to the Commonwealth, and Loudoun's portion of that is approximately $413,000. We're going to be coming forward with a board item at your December 3rd meeting to go into a little bit more detail about what programs are going to be impacted. But okay. I just wanted to.
In the December 3rd board meeting?
That's correct.
That's going to be a long night. Okay. I don't have anything else. Supervisor Reed, do you have anything? Nope. All right. Let's recess this meeting, and we should have a quorum, I hope, in about 5 minutes. Thank you. Appreciate it, guys. Okay, let's go ahead and reconvene this meeting. We now let the record show we now have a quorum. So with that, on consent tonight, we have two items. Item number one, contract award commissioning services for action. Item number two, contract renewal architectural services for action. Do I have a motion to approve the consent agenda? Second. Moved by Supervisor Reed, seconded by Supervisor Williams. Discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That motion passes unanimously. Supervisors Letourneau and York absent. Let's move on to item number three, pedestrian and bicycle improvements for Atlantic Boulevard Corridor. Mr. Krobeth. Chris.
Thank you. This item pertains to a plan that we had designed and approved, and it was not included, funding for it wasn't included in CIP in previous years. So we wanted to have direction on whether or not staff should seek the funding in the out years for this project, and or if we basically just want to go ahead and shelve it at this time. The estimated cost is in the $3.5 million range, which would include having to do all the utility relocation and design and acquiring of right-of-way, along with the construction of the sidewalk and the trail. So staff is looking for direction.
That 3.5, does that include land acquisition? Does it include utility relocation?
It does not.
It does not. So the price tag could be quite a bit higher.
Could be. It's north of $6 million.
North of $6 million. Okay. Well, unfortunately, the two supervisors this most affects are not on this committee. But that said, I'm just going to make a motion. We can discuss it. But does anybody have questions first? I can. All right. I'm going to move that. And here's my issue with the item. If we give you direction to put it in the CIP, what the item is basically saying is it can probably can only be accommodated by delaying or eliminating other projects in the CIP.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hemstreet.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
I move fast.
I know. I should have jumped in earlier.
That's okay.
I think the options that we put into the memo are not as expansive as your options actually are. The other option you could have is direct us to put it into a future fiscal year, which would mean that we would bring it back in the next CIP. So it would not be a part of the current CIP process. But when you do add the next 2 years, we would bring it back as part of that, in which case it would not bump any projects that are presently there, but we would know to plan for this in the 21 or 22 fiscal years.
But for clarification, we do a biennium CIP with the FY16 budget, correct? We'd add.
No, this is an amendment year. So
this is an amendment year.
Correct. So you're not adding.
Yeah, right. 16 is the amendment year. All right. So we would include it in the FY17.
That's correct.
CIP presentation.
So when we add the additional 2 years, we could put it into one of those 2 years. If that's so, that's the other option that's out
there.
Yeah. So.
And under that scenario, it would probably fit without budding something because we're adding 2 years to the CIP. All right. Then I'm going to move the Finance, Government, Service Operations Committee recommend that the Board of Supervisors direct staff to submit the Atlantic Boulevard Pedestrian Bicycle Improvements Project for programming and funding in the biennium FY17 CIP.
Mr. Chairman, you could just say in a future fiscal year.
In a future fiscal year. Okay, thank you. Seconded by Supervisor Reed. I don't have an opening discussion.
Yeah, just for clarification, that doesn't mean we're necessarily committing to fiscal year 17. Right. It just means that we're going to look at the capacity in the entire CIP at some point. Is that?
That's correct, yes. We're looking at the CIP that goes from FY17 to FY22.
Correct. Our interpretation of the direction would be that it would not be in any of the fiscal years that are currently populated unless something moves out for some reason that provides room.
Okay.
I will be supporting this motion.
Okay. All right. Other discussion? No closing. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Supervisors Letourneau and York absent. Let's move on to item five, monthly report implementation of the ERP project. And it looks like this month, this could be a little more of a exciting item. So, welcome.
Good evening. I'll just jump right into this. For phase one of the Oracle ERP, that's in full production support, and there are no significant issues to report at this time. For phase two, since our last meeting, we did have three deliverables that were completed, and there are three that are delayed. The first one there is for interfaces. We're about 98% complete on those interfaces. There's one that's outstanding. However, the full impact of that on the schedule is not fully assessed yet because we haven't completed the systems integration testing event yet. But the Loudoun PMO is monitoring that, and we'll assess the full impact of that. For the second bullet there, which is test scripts, we're about over 90% complete on those. However, there is some refinement continuing with those, so those won't be fully completed until the SIT event is over. Then the third bullet is the Oracle Analytics release of the ERP implementation funds money. The only reason that's showing as delayed is because this actual meeting was pushed a week because of the Veteran Day's holiday. So that's where that one is. In regards to the systems integration testing event, we're a little over 50% complete overall. However, we're about 85% through the total duration of that testing event, which has the team concerned. The report that you currently have has some statistics in it, but I have updated numbers as of today, so I'm going to give you those. For example, we've completed almost 700 test scripts so far with fairly good results. But we still have over 500 to be completed by December 2nd. And as you know, next week is a holiday week with Thanksgiving. So we have a very short period of time to complete a lot of test scripts. And the primary reason that we are behind in completing these test scripts is because AST has fallen behind in configuration and development of the various modules. We did coordinate the testing to be in waves to try to time when testing should occur for certain functionality, but we're still working on test scripts that were started in wave one, simply because a lot of the development had not been completed. So this has resulted in a compounding of the test scripts, which is going to place a burden on the Loudoun resources to complete all of this. So now we're looking at completing 500 test scripts in a very short period of time. So we do anticipate an increased workload on the Loudoun testers to get through this backlog of testers. And for this reason, this is why the steering committee does remain concerned about this project overall. And we did summarize all of our concerns, and we sent AST a letter documenting all these and stating our concerns. We did that last week. In the Loudoun Project Management Office, we're continuing to monitor the project activities. We are working very closely with AST, and we're working as a team to try to mitigate any schedule slippage. Like I said earlier, we don't know the full impact of the schedule yet because the SI systems integration testing event is not complete yet. But there most likely will be an opportunity to add resources, especially in the December timeframe, because we will be requesting release of some additional funds in our next finance committee meeting. So if we have to add more resources in order to maintain the schedule, that's what we'll try to plan to do. And if there's an opportunity to fast track certain tasks within the schedule, that's another opportunity to try to get back on track. So the Loudoun PM is monitoring that, and we'll try to take the action that we can. But as you know, we are totally reliant on the AST as a systems integrator for getting us through the implementation and showing their expertise in this area. So we are going to continue to work towards the March 2/15 go live date, but if the systems integration testing event does exceed the current scheduled finish date and bleeds more into December than we would like, it's going to have a domino impact on future events and deliverables like user acceptance testing and parallel testing. But we're going to have to continue to monitor that, like I said, fast track the schedule if we can and where we can, and add resources if that will, in effect, allow us to proceed and still go live in March of 2015. Are there any questions on that?
Go ahead and finish what you have.
So we do have an action tonight. We are requesting the release of $390,000 for the ERP from the ERP implementation fund. These were planned expenses, so no additional money. And I do want to point out that there was a typo in the previous report where we had the year 2014 for three of the items, Oracle Annual Maintenance, Vertex, and Windstar. That's 88, 89, and 90. It should have been 2014, it's not 2015. And then also I want to point out that in next month for line item 63, to extend or add AST resources, that wasn't intended to be exclusive to AST only, and so I'd like to modify that to include other third-party support as well and not make it solely exclusive to AST. So that'll be a modification I'd like to make for the next month. That concludes my report.
Okay. I'm sure everybody's got questions. Let me throw a couple out. The letter you sent AST, is that a cure letter? What is it? What have you sent them?
It was a letter outlining all of our concerns. We've actually outlined our exit criteria for systems integration testing. So those were specific criteria that had to be met before we, Loudoun County, would consider that event complete. And they subsequently have agreed to that exit criteria. So we are moving in the right direction, but we did want to document all of our concerns, and we pointed out specifically where they were falling behind in some development configuration items.
Is AST applying proper resources?
They have applied resources. However, as I reported previously, I would have preferred they would have applied them sooner, which compounded the reason of why we are where we are. But AST, from their perspective, is saying that they applied the resources that they needed to apply.
Well, obviously, they didn't. What is our contract with them? And what I mean by that is it hourly? Is it fixed price? What is it?
Fixed price.
Fixed price.
Yes.
Okay. What are the ramifications if they don't meet these deadlines? What are our options?
From a project implementation perspective, if we miss deliverables and they affect future deliverables, then ultimately it could impact the go-live date, which means...
No, I understand critical path. What I'm saying is what are our contractual options or what are the contractual ramifications to AST if they miss?
You mean from like a liquidated damages perspective? Yeah,
for example, yes.
I do not believe our contract has liquidated damages. However, we do have a performance bond included in the contract.
Okay.
We also have the ability. I mean, the contract is set up. It is, as we said, fixed price, but it's as milestones are reached. You know, they're not getting paid for SIT until we're satisfied SIT is
right,
done.
Right.
So that's one of the sticks that we have right now is
right.
That we're not paying them until that piece is done.
Okay. So since it's fixed price, it's on their nickel to get it done. Correct.
Yes. We have specific criteria that must be met before we accept it.
Okay. The ERP implementation fund, did we build, and I don't remember, this is just a question, did we build a contingency into that? Does the project have a contingency?
The original project had a contingency in it.
And we've spent that?
There's roughly $185,000 left from the original
contingency.
Because remember, there were two other projects with
yeah,
the ERP.
Right.
So overall, because the tax project is still going on, so overall that program available balance is in the $180,000 range.
Does it help you if we release the December funds early?
Yes. To start looking for resources to help internally, yes.
Definitely.
Okay. That would affect any motion made tonight. Maybe not getting to production in March. Schedule-wise, I'm a little less concerned. But monetarily, there is no worse time for us to have to throw more money at this project. We've already thrown $10 million more. The schools have thrown a lot more at it. And we have a very, as you know, challenging budget coming, and I'm very concerned about the cost side. If it slips a little schedule-wise, that's one thing, but if it slips from a cost perspective, we have a huge problem on our hands. So, Supervisor Williams.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up a little bit of where Supervisor Bono was going. I'd like for us to look at our existing performance-based contract, because we should have SLAs at a minimum. We should, in these milestones, they should be tied to dates. And any commercial contract will have damages and remedies for the county if they're slipping on schedule. It's not just enough to say they're going to be done if there's no date tied to that deliverable. And maybe that's in there, Ben. I don't know if there's their date tied to the milestones, and if they slip beyond a milestone date, there is damages, but it sounds as though the damages are connected to the ultimate date of turn-on. So is it their intent that they, even if they have to catch up or they get a little behind one milestone, they will catch up and the ultimate delivery will still meet the date?
I don't believe there are specific penalties for a deliverable missing its planned finish date. However, payment will not be made until that deliverable is accepted. So though there's not a penalty, there is a payment that that can be withheld.
Right. They won't get paid until they do what they said they're going to do. I get you completely.
Yes.
With that deliverable, is there a date?
Every deliverable does have a date.
Okay. So if they don't make the deliverable on time,
there's no penalty. There's just no payment until they reach it. And then at the end of the project, then, you know, if it has slipped and there are monetary issues involved, that's going to be a set of discussions we have to have with them at that point.
Okay, so currently, if the entire project doesn't come in on time, is it $1,000 a day? Is it what's the damages for not being able to deliver?
I don't believe there are any liquidated damages in our contract.
Sorry.
But we withhold retainage also on every one of those milestones.
Okay.
So there's a certain percentage that's being withheld in retainage, and so that money is set aside.
Okay, I know exactly what you mean. Is it 10%, Wendy?
20.
Okay. That's okay. I think that's what we're trying to find out, you know, what our leverage is here to kind of keep the pressure up to make sure that we're at least moving on time. And Supervisor Chairman Bona, is there if your motion was going to include the December payment, is that a figure we have at our disposal?
I'm going to ask that now. I've got number. I did numbers while Supervisor Williams was talking, okay? The original amount in the project plan showed $125,000 this month, but I think the $390,000 is the difference because of the Oracle and all those other things. So it's the $125,000 plus those, correct?
Yes.
Is the December release amount $791,000?
Well, that was for two items in December. One is $500,000 for additional resources, and then the other was to extend the project management contract for an additional 6 months.
So is it $791,000? Penny, maybe you can help me with this. That's what this shows, but I want to make sure I've got the right number. Because Oracle, you showed us 15 originally, these other items, but it was really 14, and we're releasing that tonight.
Yes.
So if it's $791,000, I'm showing a total of $1.181 million. Correct?
Correct.
And how would it help you if we release the December funds now?
We could start onboarding additional resources now that would help with the user acceptance testing event.
Would those resources have to run longer, therefore that's additional cost? Or are we just gaining a jump on something?
Probably a little of both.
It's the additional costs, again, that are troubling.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If I may. Just to put this in perspective, we haven't missed a milestone date yet.
Agreed.
So the SIT completion milestone date is the end of November?
December 2nd.
Or December 2nd. So the problem is we only have 2 weeks left in the month. We're
at
60 or just over 50% completion. What AST could do is they could add a bunch of resources at the last second and give us all the deliverables by that date.
Yep.
So what the staff is saying is if we advance the December money, the $500,000 for the additional resources, that would allow us to ramp up to be able to do our end of it, because there's a piece that we do and a piece that they do. We can't do our piece because we don't have theirs yet. So just to make that clear, they haven't missed anything yet, which is what makes it a little challenging. So what happens is by adding the additional resources, it allows us to perhaps accelerate user acceptance testing a little bit. So it's hard to say that because we don't know what the quality is of the product of the test scripts that we're going to receive.
Right.
So in a perfect world, if every test script that we're provided by AST works and none of them fail, then we may be able to go through the completion of SIT relatively quickly, and the additional resources then allow us to jump into user acceptance testing and potentially get back on track. The problem is if those test scripts come from additional resources that are thrown right. onto the project, which are technically competent, however, have no history in the project, they may be able to give us scripts that work, but they don't work. They work for the unit, but they don't work for the integration. That you understand what I'm saying? And so then we have to spend additional resources. So it's hard to say exactly what that cost would
be.
Yeah,
until you see them, I understand. If we release those resources, the December monies, doesn't mean you have to ramp everybody up. I mean, you can ramp up as you feel it's right based upon getting those scripts and seeing what we have. But it gives you the flexibility to do so.
If I could add, we are already looking at where we could pull from internal resources at the moment to be on the ready for when these development objects become available to us. So we're already looking internally to see what we can do to be ready for this logjam when it finally breaks through and we're ready to go to it to do the testing that needs to be done.
Have you talked to AST about additional qualified resources?
We have. We have, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to expand that line item from December to other third-party support and not exclusive to AST, because we may want to use other vendors that may not only be less expensive, but we have more control over the quality of what they can provide.
Okay. And Petty, confirm, $1.181 million.
In terms of what we're looking for?
If we release November...
Right.
Including the $265,000 that was behind the mistaken date, the $125,000 for the Oracle Analytics, and the $791,000 slotted into December.
It's $790,000 and $390,000, or $791,000.
And $390,000, that's $1,181,000. All right, I'm going to move that the Finance Government Service Operations Committee approve the release of $1,181,000 from the ERP Implementation Fund for Oracle Analytics Development, Oracle Annual Maintenance, and Tax Table Renewals, plus those activities planned for the December funding, as required for the implementation of the Enterprise Resource Planning Project.
Second.
Seconded by Supervisor Williams. I don't have an opening. Supervisor Williams.
Just a real quick question, Chairman. There will be, so at this point, there will be no December allocation request for the program, correct?
That's correct.
And secondly, when you asked for third-party resources, we're not asking for third-party resources to do work that's within the ACT scope, correct?
AST scope? That's correct. No,
okay.
We're not.
Because it's firm fixed price. We don't want to add to their, they have to.
No, these would support Loudoun, on the Loudoun side only.
But that's for us, not them. Fair
that's
enough.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, their horses are eating hay and they're not going to get paid, so they have an incentive here. So, okay.
I had one question, Ben, and Wendy. We gave you authority last year around this time to hire, I think, a total of, what, 7 FTEs? Are they all on board now?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So they're involved with the implementation?
We had one, and they are on board. They've been on board for a long time.
Same for MFS?
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Supervisors Letourneau and York absent. Folks, I'm going to do some jumping around the agenda since Supervisor Letourneau isn't here. And also items 11 and 12, I'm going to reverse them on the agenda when I get to them tonight because it's a more natural flow for item 12 to come in front of item 11 since they are related. I'm going to move down to item 10, compensation for the Board of Directors of Loudoun Water for action. Mr. Davis, welcome. Mr. Jennings.
Good
Mr. Chairman, I'll introduce the item just very briefly. At the last committee meeting, you had requested that we return with a specific request and information from Loudoun Water regarding their interest in seeking increases in compensation for the Loudoun Water Board of Directors. As you recall, the compensation for the Loudoun Water Board of Directors is set by the Board of Supervisors, but the funds for their compensation is paid out of Loudoun Water funds. So with us today is Fred Jennings, who is the Chief Executive of Loudoun Water. We'd be happy to answer any questions you have at this time.
Okay, welcome, Mr. Jennings. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
I think it's a
microphone.
Thank you. I think it's been captured in the memo. We don't really know when the last increase was. Our records only go back to the year 2000, and no one can recall when. So even if we assume it was immediately upon that, it's been coming up on 15 years. This board has been generous in its appointments in the last several years. We have executive vice presidents and senior vice presidents from the banking community. We have two members who own their own firms. I need to continue that and to find really sharp business acumen and attract some individuals. I'll even be proffering additional names of folks I think are available. And to do that in comparison to our peer group in the immediate area at DC Water, but particularly Fairfax and Prince William County Service Authority, our numbers are fairly significantly out of alignment. We have looked over the last, since I've been associated with that board in 2005, and the level of work has increased fairly significantly and is continuing to do even more. We, like you, are involved in an enterprise resource planning process that has consumed an inordinate amount of time. We need to continue that investment, so I need the board involved in an investment or technology investment committee. We're evolving into new areas of business, and I need them participating in an enterprise risk management committee. So having not only is their workload doubled or tripled so far, I have a lot more expectation for how I can harvest the expertise, and I need that quality of board member. And that's why we're requesting this transition at this time.
Okay. And just to confirm, this requires Board of Supervisors approval, but it would come from Loudoun Water's budget, not the county budget, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let me open up for questions. And Supervisor Reed?
There's an analogy here to Prince William County. I know they also have the Lower Occoquan Authority. How many customers does Prince William Sanitation Authority have versus Loudoun Water?
I'd have to look it up. The last time I did, they were slightly larger than us, but not much.
And you're saying that we're having a problem getting qualified board members, so we need to raise the compensation.
I don't think we've had a problem so far, but it's getting more difficult. I have one board member in particular I've mentioned to the Assistant County Administrator finally is agreeing. He's a returning board member from a long time ago. He's extremely busy, runs his own firm, and has in the past run our finance committee. Attracting people like that, it's easier rather than my saying to them, would you be on the board if I can proffer the name to the Board of Supervisors? I'd like them to feel commensurate importance to, I think that's consistent with the kind of decisions I'm asking them. So I don't think we've been hamstrung yet, but to continue as we grow, I think the decisions that are going to be made become even more important, and that's why I'm trying to continue a trend of making sure we have the top quality we can attract.
Well, my experience with this going back to actually the 2004 when I was involved with helping get the board members elected at that time is that this is really it's a political decision by the Board of Supervisors. We had a member who was a holdover from the prior board who had a lot of engineering experience, and she wasn't kept on. I wanted to get somebody on here who is living with a water problem in Hamilton but has been kind of a firebrand in conservative politics, and so he was rejected. But there seems to be never a shortage of people applying for these positions, and I think given the situation that's happened with Raspberry and with Red Hill Towers, I think that this sets a bad
thing for us to be raising your compensation at this time, so I will not be supporting it. Thank you.
Okay, seeing no other discussion, I'm going to make a motion. I will give an opening. I'm going to move that the Finance, Government Services, and Operations Committee recommend to the Board of Supervisors compensation for the Lot and Water Board of Directors be set at a level of $1,000 per month, $12,000 annually for the chairman, and $800 per month, $9,600 annually for members, effective January 1st, 2015. Second. Seconded by Supervisor Williams. And Ms. Jennings, January 1st is the beginning of your fiscal year?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, maybe this isn't the best of timing in some respects, but I don't think you tie water towers and things like that into this request. Nobody can determine when the last adjustment was made. All we know is it's been at least 15 years and maybe a lot longer. We are significantly under neighboring jurisdictions. This puts us in line with those neighboring jurisdictions. There's no doubt that the capital budget has increased drastically, that the workload has gone up. This is still quite a bit under where our planning commission is, and I don't think the workload's the same as the planning commission, but I do think it's still a reasonable workload. I don't think $1,000 a month for the chairman and $800 for members is extraordinary at all, and I think we should get in line with our neighbors. Again, this is not the county budget. This is from Loudoun Water's budget. And I don't think that this small annual increment is going to really have any effect on our constituents' water rates. Would you agree with that, Mr. Jennings?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Point of information.
Well, that was my opening. Hang on.
Sure.
All right. Mr. Reed.
You say in line with other authorities, Prince William Sanitation Authority said has more customers, and yet they pay the chairman $850 a month and $800 a month for members, so we're going to be paying our people more.
Our chairman is currently paid $500 per month.
I understand that, but this is a very large increase, and we're going to be paying them more than Prince William. I just wanted to make that note for the record.
Mr. Letourneau?
So does the Loudoun Water Board get to adjust the Board of Supervisors' salaries? I have a better chance of happening.
I'll second that.
Actually, we may not want that. They may go down.
They might cut us.
I don't have any problem with this. It's a complicated system. We set about trying to find people with a lot of technical expertise to serve on the Loudoun Water Board, and I think we have changed the makeup of the board a little bit in that regard. But with that, we also have put people on who are busy and who have a lot of demands on their time. And, you know, just like with the Board of Supervisors, we want to at least make it so that this is not a big disincentive to serve, financial reasons. So I don't have any problem. I understand they'll be a little bit over where Prince William is, but, you know, again, it depends on when different jurisdictions change things. They could very well up their rates for the next term, and then, you know, who knows. So I think this is in line, and unlike other discussions, as has been pointed out, this is paid for by Loudoun Water. So,
Mr. Williams? Oh, you had your light on. Okay. I don't have any closing. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, that motion carries 3-1-1. Supervisor Reed opposed. Chairman York absent. Let the record show that Supervisor Letourneau is now present. And Supervisor Letourneau, we've covered items 1 through 5 and item 10. Let's move on to item 6, proposed revisions to the Loudoun County fiscal policy. And do I have staff, Janet? Yes.
Good evening.
Good evening. I will note that I had originally put this on the consent agenda after spending quite a bit of time with staff going through every change in the document one by one. Supervisor Reed did ask that it be removed from consent. He did submit some questions, which staff responded today, so hopefully everybody's got those. So go ahead, Janet.
The last time we updated this policy, our fiscal policy was in 2011, and that was primarily due to a change in our GASB regulations, which required an updated language and fund balance. Since then, we've, had some issues with our cash flows and our bond fundings, and we decided it was a good opportunity to look at how we had that in our fiscal policy and decided to revise our funding flow so that we were spending restricted assets first. And in the process, we decided it was a good opportunity to update the entire policy to reflect
a lot of our current practices that have changed over the years, and just make some minor language changes, and you had that before you.
There are a couple additions and changes that are maybe of note. I think one is the fact that it concerns going to referendum to the voters, and that we are now making it a policy that we can go for the whole project at one time rather than confusing voters going maybe for design and land and having to go with a second referendum for construction, correct?
Yes, we changed the language to broaden it to give you the opportunity to do that. That's not to say that you can't break it up differently. It just gives you the opportunity to take an entire project to referendum at one time rather than trying to do the preliminary phases first, followed by the construction.
Right. The board would still have the option to go with multiple referendum questions if we chose, but we're trying to say our policy is we'd like to consolidate them.
Right.
Okay. Another significant was the revolving fund, correct?
Yes. We changed the revolving fund. At this point, we don't have a lot of money left in that revolving fund. We had been using it for some water and wastewater issues, but we have a new policy that is being developed to address those. And then we're limiting it to fire and rescue and their construction projects to support them in construction projects.
Okay, and one last thing. There's a little inconsistency, I think, between the markup in the document itself versus your summary of changes. And this was an addition I personally asked to be added to this document, and that was that we would update the capital intensity factor preferably every 2 years, but no more than every 4 years. Mm-hmm. In the summary, it says no less than every 4 years.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but when we get to items 11 and 12, we can talk about why that's the case. But I'll just summarize. The last time we updated the capital intensity factor was in 2009. A lot's happened in the county in those 5 years, and we feel the Fiscal Impact Committee ought to be try with staff, and that's the long pole in the tent, to do it every 2 years, especially if we see rezonings and so forth coming. So I also ask that that be added. Anything, any others you want to highlight?
The other one that I would add is that we've added some policies at the very end of the document
PPTAs.
With regard to due diligence and public-private partnerships. In general, our experience had been over the last, you know, over the last decade, that the state has given us more tools, both CDAs and PPTAs and PPEAs, to meet different needed capital improvements. But in many cases, we wind up negotiating with a somewhat naked LLC on the other side. And we're somewhat uncomfortable with staff with that, because who knows who we're really dealing with 5 years down the line, and how you know, and we just thought it was time to add some more language on due diligence to firm up the negotiations.
It makes sense. We're seeing more of them. We have the Metro parking garages potentially under that arrangement. I think having these guidelines and requiring financial due diligence and opening of their books and things like that makes a lot of sense. Questions or comments from the committee? Mr. Reed?
Thank you very much. It says here, you're crossing out this part here where the county may assist volunteer fire and rescue companies through the revolving loan program. You're cutting out the part about towns, authorities, and other public or quasi-public entities which serve the citizens of the county. I'm trying to think back on my time in the town council. I can't think of a time when we borrowed money from the county, but have any towns or has Loudoun Water or other entities actually borrowed money from the county? Were you taking this out because it just never has happened?
No, it had happened many, many years ago, and I understand, and the budget book actually reflects a description of the revolving loan much closer to what we have here in the policy.
Because what you're doing here is you're restricting it just to fire and rescue companies.
Right. Right.
Why is that? What's the point of – why would you take away the towns or, let's say, Loudoun Water if they want to borrow money or something? They have
frankly, with Loudoun Water, they have a fairly significant retained earnings amount. They would really rarely ever have to borrow into a fund that only has $1 million. And the towns, for the most part, we now have a process where if the towns are looking at capital facilities – that they have an opportunity as part of each fall's capital improvement program to actually request that the county, either in partnership with them or on its own, fund projects. We didn't actually have that as part of a process prior to this point in time. So there's, again, probably less need for the towns to access these kind of funds. And quite frankly, for the last 15 years, it's been almost exclusively used by the fire and rescue companies. It was used for both capital construction and vehicles in the past by fire and rescue. We have, again, though, as changes that we've made over the last, you know, half decade, changed the way we're purchasing equipment for the volunteer fire companies, and we've rolled that up as part of the, for example, the most recent, you know, bond, mm-hmm. referendum and bond deals. So we're taking care of equipment at that point. So at this point in time, to us, it seemed to make sense to limit this to what almost certainly is the vast majority of the future customers, which is any capital construction projects from the fire and rescue companies.
Well, what the reason, and that was one of the reasons why I took this off consent, and you see the questions I asked, because I was concerned about the 10% cash requirement. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Mace, for explaining that. But why don't you explain what, during the break, we discussed about the towns basically kicking in for some of these. Like, we're getting into a lot of road construction projects. And, you know, there's this money, the NVTA money and the state money is going to be limited for construction. So what would be wrong with having something in the policy where we could at least just add a few words to say, or in the case of the town government's funds from the town? Because you mentioned, I'm trying to find the part here in the fiscal policy, I'm sorry, where there was some reference to the contribution to that 10% requirement.
Mr. Mays, if I may, I don't think we'd ever turn down somebody else's money if they wanted to hand it to us. But that said, is it correct to assume and
capital
say...
Capital construction section.
Yeah, but right. Is it correct to say that this 10% is a budget number across the entire CIP? This new policy, correct?
Right, and that has
and,
been
and
the practice.
Let me finish my question. And so. The second half is... that by putting it across the whole CIP, we're giving ourselves the flexibility to say, well, maybe we'll do all cash on this one and only put 7% down on this one, correct?
Right. That's exactly it. We wanted to be able to have that flexibility so that smaller projects that you might want to move forward quickly will have cash available for those rather than trying to wait to bond fund them. It just makes more sense in smaller projects, in some cases, to cash fund it.
Nothing precludes... on any capital project, for there to be a town contribution. For example, again, on the fifth floor, for anyone who's actually watching this on television, there was a little plaque outside the Leesburg room describing the town's contribution to actually build this building. There's still a plaque that commemorates the town's contribution to that. And we would expect, I mean, the town of Lovettsville, you know, we're doing park projects with them, others, we're doing some water projects with town contributions. So those always are available there.
Well, yes, they are, if I may, Mr. Chairman. They are available, but you see, there seems to be, like, for instance, of course, I've only been on the board for 3 years, but some things tend to be leapfrogged because there's incredible demand or pressure from in certain areas. And, you know, unfortunately, with Leesburg, at least, I don't know about Purcellville or Middleburg, they tend to just do their own CIP, and we've had a series of issues where the town council doesn't seem to bother to ask for help with capital projects. So, you know, sometimes it befalls me or maybe some of my predecessors to try to do certain things. So I'm wondering, is there a problem just to add a couple of words through use of local tax funding, fund balance, and other recurring loan revenue sources? And in the case of towns, funds from the town. Is that a problem?
We could look and see if that fits in another section. In this particular piece, it's not really necessarily appropriate, sir, because in this piece, this is a policy where you're basically making sure that we are directed when we prepare the CIP to make sure that there's at least 10% cash.
Well, if there's
no
objection, then I'd like to have them look into that. That'd be great.
We can look and see if that will fit somewhere in another section.
I'm not supportive of that, so Mr. Reed and I are going to have to talk about that. This is a county fiscal policy where the board is directing county staff on how we would like you to develop the CIP, deal with debt, and things like that. This is not about the towns. If the towns want to make requests, there is a process to do that. If the towns want to help fund, there is a process to do that. This document, in my mind, is not the appropriate place for this type of language. I'm going to move that the Finance, Government, Service, and Operations Committee recommend that the Board of Supervisors adopt the revised fiscal policy as shown in Attachment 1.
Second.
Seconded by Supervisor Letourneau. This is a very straightforward document. These are very good changes. But Janet, let me ask one last change. You said this was our question. You said this was last changed in 2011, but it's my understanding that was more of a, almost a cleanup type of change. When was the last substantive change to this document made?
Oh, I'm not sure. In 2011, they added the section on fund balance. I think that was primarily the change in that year.
My recollection, I don't hold me to the exact date, is, you know, when Mr. Adams and Mr. Withrow was the controller, so probably about 2009, we did a rewrite at that point in time. But it's been 5 years since a substantial rewrite. It's more than time to look at it again.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Reed.
Thank you. And I want to thank you for your diligence in doing this, Mr. Chairman, because these policies are very important.
They are.
And I'm surprised that, well, anyway, I'm glad you did this, so I want to thank you for your leadership. I did have one concern about this item on the Finance Committee, saying the county will maintain an ongoing internal audit function for the performance of fiscal programmatic and operation audits as determined by the board's Finance Committee. So that means it doesn't go to the full board for approval?
This is a broadening or really stating what we're doing with our internal audits. Right now we have a contract for our internal audit firm, and they come to the Finance Committee and request some feedback from you on what you find important and what you would like them to do. The Finance Committee is essentially the audit committee.
Okay, so you don't feel we need to go to the full board?
First of all, this is not a financial audit. If you remember, we've done two or three of these now. We did the credit cards. We did, I think, the proffer fund. These are internal audits using an external auditor to look at a specific program or area to make sure we're in compliance with our policies. And I think Janet's point's extremely important. The Finance Committee is the audit committee of the Board of Supervisors, and that's why the results come to us.
Okay, so therefore, we don't need, I was just wondering whether we're bypassing full board approval or something there. Okay, thank you. Well, I'm good with this. I appreciate it. I'll get with you about this other thing, Ben. Thank you.
One quick thing on that. Should the Finance Committee see an internal audit or one of these audits, and we want to take certain actions, we would have the prerogative to take that to full board approval. So we aren't shutting out the rest of the board. Okay, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 4-0-1. Chairman York, absent. All right, let's move on to Supervisor Turner. I'm not going to talk to you about your phone, but I know you have a time constraint. Let's pop a quick item. Let's do item number 9, potential mods to Eastgate Park and Ride Project. This is in Supervisor Turner's district.
All right, very quickly, and I'll make a motion in just a second. You all remember this discussion. We were discussing maybe some changes to the project, given the fact that we may have a need at future time for more spaces at the commuter lot. Where we kind of landed was to move forward with the field. The field could be converted back to parking spaces at a future date, but we were also planning to put lights on this athletic field. If we made that expense, then we really wouldn't want to convert this back. And so what we've kind of worked out here is that we'll install the infrastructure to put in the lights, but not the actual lights. And that can be a decision that's made down the road once we have some idea what the demand is for the park and ride lot. This is in an area that does not currently have a park and ride lot. It will likely feature new service to Metro. We really don't know what kind of demand there's going to be. It could be enormous demand, in which case we may need to look at additional spaces, or the 218 spaces could be adequate. So I will move that the Finance, Government Services, and Operations Committee recommend that the Board of Supervisors direct staff to issue a stop work order on the fabrication of the athletic field lighting to the general contractor of the approved Eastgate Park and Ride facility until the Board directs staff to install the lighting or to complete the design of additional parking for the Park and Ride facility.
Motion is made by Supervisor Turner, seconded by Supervisor Williams.
Just by way of opening, I did discuss this with the Eastgate Homeowners Association. A lot of the residents there are not overly excited about having the park and ride lot in the first place and do like the athletic field, but they were very much unaware of the plan to light the field, and I think that is another issue that we would want to work out in the future if we decide to proceed with the lit field.
I just have one question, and that is, fiscal impact says, should the lighting not be fabricated, potential savings of $154,900 would be realized. If it had been manufactured but not installed, we'd have a labor savings of about $25,000. If the Finance Committee approves this motion tonight and the board approves this on December 3rd, is it safe that the lights have not been manufactured and we will realize the full $154,900 savings?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Any closing? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Chairman York absent. Thank you. Let's move on to item 7, challenges to service delivery and benefits and child services in the Department of Family Services. I know when I jump around, folks in the audience go, darn, I thought I was getting out of here. I did. Yeah. Welcome. I notice there's a PowerPoint in here. Are you going to? Is your plan to go through the PowerPoint?
If you would like for us to do that.
Just run through it real quickly.
Okay. I'm here with Sarah Coiletro and Hope Stonerick from the Family Services Board. And also, I would like to acknowledge Brian Kay, who is on the Family Services Board. And to let you know that the Family Services Board met Monday night in a special session to acknowledge their support for this item. So Brian is in the audience tonight. We're here to inform you about the workload increases and benefits in child services that are taxing our capability to effectively serve the public and also to meet the state and federal mandates. And at the same time, or it was after we began to prepare information for the county administrator that we learned from the Loudoun County Public Schools that they had made a decision to end the MOU for the Young Adults Project. So that provides us an opportunity to be able to maximize the use of the FTEs associated with that program and to be able to draw down state funding create the resources that we need to address the issues that we have in benefits and child services without the addition of any new local tax funds. So we can take you quickly through the PowerPoint. If you have any questions, just let us know.
I'm going to start talking a little bit about the benefits unit and what is required there. As Ellen said, what we are looking for is a redistribution of the funds from the YAP program, so not actually asking for additional new funds. We've seen a tremendous increase in applications for Medicaid, 110%, and an 80% increase in screenings for all of the programs that are in benefits. Benefits oversees 5 mandated federal programs: Medicaid, food stamps, TANF, which is Temporary Aid to Needy Families, among others. Go ahead to the next slide. Hope, thanks. Each of those programs has a prescribed time frame with which the applications need to be reviewed. So, for example, food stamps for regular case is 30 days, Medicaid is 45 days. And the mandate from the state is that we do the work with 97% of the applications are done within the prescribed time frames. The state, in order to meet requirements from the Affordable Care Act, as well as to upgrade some antiquated systems, has introduced a tremendous number of systems changes with the technology, as well as new policies that have come on into play because of legislative changes affecting eligibility criteria and so forth. That has complicated, in addition to an increase in applications, what the unit has needed to support and is not able to meet any of the mandates for any of the programs at this time. The overriding issue is the increase in applications, especially for Medicaid. This slide just gives you a little bit of a sketch of what the state is doing and what some of those changes are, and I'm going to just kind of skip through it unless you all have a question about it. I do want you to know, though, that as we've seen this coming, we have tried within our existing resources to address the various initiatives and changes that we've seen coming. We've restructured the benefits unit to try to have a more efficient and more direct line of supervision to give more support to workers. We added a long-term temp position in the lobby to help citizens apply online. One new thing the state introduced is an online application to these benefits programs. We have had the benefit of some consultant services paid for by the state. The state is looking at all social service departments and is providing services to many of them to help us all get up to speed where we need to be. We've converted our files to LaserFish. We tried various efficiency moves, for example, bank caseloads, to see if we could reduce the amount of time it took to process applications. And, of course, we renovated our lobby. We added a bank of computers as well as telephones to give more access to clients, to workers, and also to state help. And we've set up some dedicated teams. There are additional initiatives that we are faced with in coming months and years. The complete conversion to the new state computer system will occur in April of 2016, so we still have a long way to go with many systems changes. In the meantime, we are using two systems at one time, which causes confusion, and the state does not have many of the kinks worked out of the computer system. We did look at what is happening per worker within the unit, and this chart tries to show you kind of what the workload is. Each worker has 150 hours per month that they're paid for, and when you look at the applications that are coming in, both new ones and recertifications, what is assigned per worker, and the standard amount of time, and we take this from a state standard, it takes to process, does not include when you have to provide translation services, that usually doubles or triples the amount of time required, or when there's a complicated application. So it's a kind of a minimum standard. What we determined is that we have more work than FTEs, and that's basically what this chart is trying to show you.
I'm going to move along just to talk a little bit about child services very briefly. And when we talk about child services, I'm talking specific child protective services and foster care at this time. Our department's mandated to provide ongoing services to families that are deemed high risk for future abuse or neglect. And the purpose really of ongoing is really to prevent anything more from happening or prevent something from happening to start with. We assess cases after every investigation or a family assessment. There's a standardized tool that the state gives us that measures the risk level to that family, and we are really supposed to be serving all of those families that meet high risk. At this time, the number of high-risk cases outweighs our ability to meet that. We can't serve all the families that need to be served. We can look at buying services, and we do that. We look at services such as home-based services or counseling by other entities, but the family situation really needs to be monitored by a child protective services worker, and we just do not have the staff to do that at this time. Really, in a nutshell, we have a lot of best practices, we have caseload standards, and we have mandates that we need to meet. And when the workers cannot meet the mandates and the standards, really the safety risk of the children increase. Along with benefits, we've looked at a lot of initiatives to address our increasing workload. We've transferred staff between foster care and CPS. When one of those units' workload gets a little bit low, we kind of transfer between the two, but right now both units have an increase in workload, so that's not working for us. In the summer months, the young adult staff has helped out these units. We did have a case aid that was added in FY13, which was a great benefit to us. We've trained additional staff to help with redacting files. We have other units that have been helping with our different child protective services cases, such as our CSA units helping to arrange services quicker. We've helped we've worked with the community in developing new programming. Family Connections triages our cases. But basically, we're just not meeting the need. So,
the last slide is just sums it up. You can see how much money is, how many funds are available in the Young Adults Project budget. And the resources that we need, we're able to take five positions with some O&M out of the young adults budget, and we've been able to maximize that because those positions would then go into mandated programs, and in mandated programs we're able to draw down state funding for that. So we've been able to maximize that by adding another $152,000 so that we would be able to meet all of our needs in child services and benefits in FY16.
Okay, thank you. The reason I asked you to go through the PowerPoint is the numbers are quite staggering. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want one of these jobs. And there's not a day that goes by that all of us don't receive an email saying, and many emails saying, do this or do that because we're the wealthiest county in America. This shows some of the other side of what happens in Loudoun County. I think it's important that those numbers be presented. Let me open it up to the committee. Supervisor Williams.
Thank you, and I appreciate that, Chairman, and have so much confidence in Ellen and her team, what they do. I do, the board's represented on the Family Services Board, although I don't make it many Thursdays, and Caleb started school, so we'll try to get someone in there, but you guys do a great job. This is exactly the kind of leadership, Ellen, that we want from departments at the county level. For you to be able to go in there, no one knows your department better than you do, and for you to be able to move resources around and manage the increasing intense workload and basically stay fiscal neutral, I just applaud you, as you know I already think. And just for the record, let me point out a few things, and then I'll put something on the table. This change eliminates the projected need for additional funding and staffing resources for the department in fiscal year 2016. The deficiencies identified in the mandated programs can be addressed mid-year. The total budget for YAP is $437,071, and the projected need to fund 2.2 FTEs in child services and 5 FTEs in benefits is $372,000 and change. So I will make a comment when we get to opening, Chairman, but I would strongly support my colleagues to support this motion, and I strongly support all department heads and to give them the ability to solve issues in their own departments through fiscally neutral means. And thank you for doing that, and thank you for what you're doing.
Turner.
Thanks. A couple questions. So with LCPS ending the MOU on the young adults program, are they going to be trying to accommodate those needs? It said in our packet that they feel like they need to be able to meet those needs within their system. But does that mean they're going to need additional resources to do that?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if, as part of a future school budget request, we're suddenly going to get a request for some portion of the funds that were being spent as part of this MOU to help them manage this program on their own.
I was going to say, Ellen, I actually have a friend that works specifically as a resource official for the schools on this very program. The policy change was that the kids that they were being helped, they were having problems at school, and there was a handful. They were getting a lot of personal attention, but they were basically being taken out of the system for as much as 3 to 4 weeks of the month. The schools thought that was a bad practice, and they were actually getting in more trouble being outside of the system for those long durations. So the school's policy has shifted to keep them in the system and provide them resources during the day. And so I don't anticipate, who knows what their budget's going to look like.
Well,
but that was a policy decision on their part. Matter of fact, the LEA representative came up to me at the Education Chamber event and said, you guys cut this program. And it was not fiscally driven whatsoever. They just thought the practice wasn't helping the kids it was intended to help.
Well, the LEA is frequently uninformed on these issues.
Supervisor Letourneau, they also have resources connected with the program.
Right.
So those resources will go back into the school.
Okay.
Sounds
like they just want to address it differently. Okay, that's helpful. The only question I was going to ask is why there's such a huge jump in FY13, for instance, the number of civil cases. Is something happening out there?
In Child Protective Services?
Yeah.
One thing that we attribute the jump to is domestic violence cases.
We haven't seen, I mean, we get, you know, we obviously get the crime reports, and at least countywide, I do a different segment, but we're not seeing huge increases there. Yeah. But you are?
A Loudoun Abused Women's Shelter, they saw a huge increase in the past year. And in many of those cases, we're seeing the children from those cases. But I think overall, it's been a very odd couple of years. We've seen an increase in teenagers coming into care and also very young babies.
And you sort of expect to see some element of this when the economy starts to do poorly. It just sinks everything. But we haven't been in that mode for the last few years. So I'm really surprised. But regardless, I agree with the sentiments of the others. Let's get some more resources into this. This is one of these basic needs that we have to fund. So,
in the increase in Medicaid applications, it's a huge number. What do you attribute that to?
I think that the state had predicted all along that we would see a 50% increase in application rates, and we knew that was coming. But it turned out for us to be 110% increase.
What do you attribute that to?
And we just attribute that to the number of people in the community that just do not have health insurance. And even though 59% of the people that make application are not eligible, they don't meet the standard, but they still do not have health insurance.
All right, I'll stay off my political high horse. Supervisor Reed.
Thank you. I'll get on it. You're saying consulting services. I thought, Ellen, you mentioned, Sarah, that you've used consulting service for Medicaid or for?
Yes, sir. And those are consultants that were paid by the state to help local social service departments across the state to be able to use the new systems that they're introducing.
Okay, so it was focused on that because, Ellen, when we had a conversation about this item, you said that you can't by state law hire contractors. You have to use paid staff to do that.
No, I understood you to say that to ask whether these services could be contracted out, and Medicaid and child services cannot be contracted out.
No, I meant for personnel.
No, we cannot contract this out to personnel, to people.
Sarah's saying that you
can
use.
No, she's not saying that.
Just to clarify for you, Supervisor Reed, the consultants were training on how to use the new systems.
Okay, so that's what it was for. It was a focus thing on the new systems.
Yes, technology.
Next question. It says in the packet that applications from ineligible individuals take just as long to process as those for eligible individuals. Can't you just dispense with an eligible application at the first disqualifying point? Like you mentioned to me over the phone that if someone does not have a Social Security number, they can't qualify. So don't you just like ask for that first, and then if they don't have it, just say goodbye? Or you're saying that all these people coming to you have met those requirements?
The 59% that I referred to are the people that go through the application process, and that requires a process of collecting documentation and also a review of all of their economic status.
But why would you go through that if, let's say, they don't have a Social Security number?
Well, in that case, you may have someone that wants to make an application. They get screened out. They wouldn't be making an application at that point.
But you're saying it says it takes you in just as much time to process ineligible individuals as eligible.
Let me help you out. That's if they've already made the application, correct?
That's correct.
But you're screening people out from not even making the application in the first place.
Okay, so you are doing that. Now, you're behind on mandated deadlines. Do you face any financial penalty from the state or the federal government?
The penalty is related to, in Virginia has a contract, like all states, with the federal government. On federally mandated programs like Child Protective Services, Medicaid, and so on. In those cases, the state will reimburse localities. Virginia will reimburse us. These are federal pass-through funds, reimburse us at 29% on FTEs in the mandated programs. We were not able to obtain any reimbursement in the positions when they were in Young Adults Project, but we are able to do that.
Okay, so if you're not meeting the deadlines, you could lose the 30% state aid.
We could.
Okay. You see, this is very interesting, colleagues. When we were at the Virginia Association of Counties meeting, I asked this question to Secretary Hazel about the, and he's all in favor of the Medicaid expansion. Would we be getting any administrative help for this? And what his staffer told me, and we were trying to track this down, was that they would pay 75%. And you're saying, Ellen, that they would not. They would pay 29%.
No.
So I find this interesting we have this huge increase in applications here, and we can't get the state to help pay for this. And I don't know why some of these people aren't going on to the exchanges.
Ellen, is it correct that we're not drawing down this 29% reimbursement rate from the state for these FTEs right now?
That's right.
Okay. So by moving them over with your innovative approach here, we would be drawing down 29% from the state, correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so we will be drawing down 29%. So therefore, in the future, because once we get these FTEs in there, there's not going to be any getting rid of them. Okay, that's why I'm asking these questions. But I will tell you that I thought it was very surprising. We don't know how many people we would add if the state adopted the Medicaid expansion. They haven't told you how many more cases in Loudoun. They haven't told you that.
They haven't told us the number of cases in Loudoun.
I just have to state this for the record, because there's this misnomer out there that somehow the expansion is not going to cost us anything. And as you learned here tonight, it will. It will cost us. And we now have more cases than Arlington, which I found very surprising. So I want to thank you for your time here. Thank you for explaining.
Supervisor Williams.
Thank you, Chairman. I'd like to get a motion on the table. I move that the Finance, Government Services and Operation Committee recommend to the Board of Supervisors that the Department of Family Services utilize $372,759 in funds from the dissolution of the Young Adults Program and unfunded FTE for the Housing Choice Voucher Program to address the critical need for staffing resources in the Benefits and Child Services Programs without the need for additional resources for these programs in fiscal year 2016.
I'll second that motion. Opening.
Thank you, Ellen, for doing what you're doing.
Other comments? Innovative approach. It's not going to cost us anything. The workload's excessive. We need to do this.
Thank you.
Closing.
And your staff.
I just want to say I was actually prepared to vote against this. And I wanted to find out about the penalty. So I don't want us to lose that state funding at all. But again, this is a proof. This proves here, even though you're saying this is not going to cost us, it is tax dollars that's going to cost us. And we will be going forward having to increase your department budget on this. I hope that we get an improvement of our economy so folks can get good insurance and not have to be on Medicaid. Thank you.
All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Chairman York absent. We have three more items. I think item number eight, hopefully, will be a quick one. Item number eight, staff resources for managing transportation projects for action. Mr. Yud, Mr. Krobeth.
Good evening, Chairman. I can just kick this off real quick as the others are assembling.
Go ahead.
You have asked us in the past to monitor the workload and to stay on top of it, and that we certainly do. One interesting fact that you saw in the item you probably picked up from the last time we reported on the quarterly report was when we transitioned into FY15, our active projects hit over $1 billion, approximately $1.4 billion in active projects. That's not the total value of projects in the CIP. That number is cropping up to about $2 billion. So with that, we have come forward with this package. It's a package of total of six. 3-2-1 are the numbers to keep in mind. 3 DTCI, 2 in Management Financial Services, and 1 in the County Attorney's Office. You can see the funding sources, capital project management, project appropriations within the capital fund. In the past, when we've come to you for additional help, we did get enhancements in the form of personnel for DTCI in about a year ago, but you also infuse the resources for contractual services. So in that pot of money, that provides us the ability to fund these positions. The management financial services positions would be funded from debt services fund and moving things around in there in their operating budget. We have included, I think, a really good discussion of the work that these positions would need to do, including the discussion about efforts in the county attorney's office. And at this time, we're recommending one new attorney for that office, but we also have the benefit of having Mr. Rogers join us this week. This is, I think, his second day on the job. Thank you very much for sticking with us.
Third.
He and Mr. Brown are in the audience, and he will be looking at current workload, evaluating his resources, and will be expected to report to the board. If that means something else, addition in FY16, then we'll see it there. We're available for any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. I can remember asking Mr. Roberts right before he retired, do you need anything else? And he said, absolutely not. I got it all handled, okay? So having dealt with some of these land use issues for transportation projects, I completely understand the problem. The number of easements, deeds, right-of-way acquisition that we're going through right now, it can be extensive. It can be 20 different properties for one little transportation segment. So I definitely see the need for it in the county attorney's office. Be careful with what you come for in the FY16 budget. Okay. Did we, Mr. Mays, and this is just a question because I don't remember. I know we plus-upped your office a while back. I know some of it was for the ERP, but was any of it for this purpose?
We added a position in procurement for transportation.
Procurement?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Williams?
Yes. I did read the staff report. This is what we asked you to do, yeah. Right? This is exactly what we asked your department and Joe and everybody to do, to basically tell us what resources you need to help us move our projects faster. So... you know how hard it is for us to agree additional funding in FTEs, but this is exactly what we asked you to do, to tell us what you needed to provide additional resources. So I'll be in supportive. Thank you.
And before I go to Ms. Letourneau, let me just ask one other question of staff. Could any of these resources be covered, or are they covered, under the capital projects? If these resources are dedicated to, let's say, capital transportation projects, could they be considered the PMO of the project and therefore be covered under the capital side of the project?
The ones outside of management and financial services are actually going to be funded out of the CIP.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Outside of MFS?
Yes.
Okay.
And the two MFS ones, one of them we're funding out of the debt service fund, and that's largely the result of the amount of reporting that we have to do now for both NVTA and the TIFIA loan. The TIFIA loan in and of itself is going to require a tremendous amount of
reporting. So the two DTCI positions and the county attorney's position will be covered out of the capital budgets.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Letourneau?
But not so the county attorney position is covered?
Yes.
Under the, oh, okay. That's the only one that I'm having a little bit of an issue with. Not because I can't believe it. It's more that I didn't believe Mr. Roberts, God bless him, when he was here telling us he didn't need more help. But I kind of have this nagging feeling now that we just hired a new county attorney who's it's his third day on a job. He is inheriting a staff of how many? 18? 19?
20.
20. I don't doubt that a lot of them are overworked at all, but I sort of feel like maybe we ought to give him a chance to take stock of what the makeup of the county attorney's office is before we add the position. Not to say that we won't end up adding the position anyway, but we're already in November. By the time you go through, a hiring process and all that, it's going to be, well within our budget season anyway. So I'm not opposed to a mid-year enhancement here. I'm not saying we have to wait till July 1, but maybe we ought to give him more than 3 days to see if there's anything he wants to do with the makeup of the county attorney's office to reallocate resources a little bit differently.
I hear you, and we did struggle with that point because obviously we're deferring to our incoming attorney to take a look and to report back. But we also every day have these issues that are enumerated in the item to deal with.
Yeah.
And I would argue that our ability to move forward to fill this position, that would be dedicated to these projects sooner rather than later would be more helpful.
And if I can point out, I've been in the heart of a few of these recently, like the Belmont Ridge Route 7 interchange. And the amount of work required from the county attorney's office was huge on this, and going back and forth with the HOAs, with the conservancy, with the developer of Lansdowne Town Center, and trying to get them off the dime and dealing with their concerns and their legal issues. And this was just one interchange project. It was an extraordinary amount of work on the county attorney's office side. We're not done with it either. We're not done. We still have a little ways to go. So I'm seeing firsthand the problem. Now, whether there's adequate resources there, it's hard to say, because frankly, it's been the other parties that have been the long pole in the tent a lot more than the county. And so are there the resources there? I don't know, but I do know this workload's expanding greatly on the county attorney's office. Other comments? Sure.
Okay, and I agree. I mean, the county attorney position, we had one point of failure for right-of-way acquisition. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not acceptable, and this is exactly what we asked them to give it to us. So I would hope we would support the county attorney position that staff, who has been here for years and years, has noted a need. I move that the Finance, Government Services, and Operation Committee recommend that the Board of Supervisors authorize the creation of six FTEs within the Department of Transportation and Capital Infrastructure, Management and Financial Services in the County Attorney's Office, and approve a budget adjustment to transfer funds from the Capital Fund to the County Attorney's Office in the amount of $57,521 from the Debt Service Fund to the Department of Management and Financial Services in the amount of $48,658 to address staff workload for transportation capital projects, transportation special funds, and other transportation-related initiatives.
I'll second the motion. Opening.
I think I've already covered it in my opening comments. I certainly think this was the ask of us and the full board to get resources to help us with these transportation projects, and I think this is what we've asked to be delivered, and I hope we support it.
Mr. Reed?
I would like to move to divide the question. I can see voting for the FTEs in the transportation department. I'm concerned about the other two positions. I'm concerned about the overall amount, which would cost more than half a million dollars in fiscal 16. And again, there could be consulting services or other things that could be examined. So I don't think the committee is going to allow any amendments or approve any amendments. So I would just like to divide the question for the three FTEs and DTCI.
Yeah, in order to divide the question, though, this motion probably isn't adequate to divide the question. We can do it from an FTE standpoint, but I can't do it from a dollar standpoint. So let's be correct here. We have one in the county attorney's office, correct?
Correct.
Three in MFS or two?
Three in
DTCI. Three in DTCI, two in MFS. All right. I'll divide the motion based on those three ways, and you can do the math depending on how the vote goes. Okay. Mr. Letourneau.
Yeah, I'm going to support all but the county attorney position. I could see myself supporting the county attorney position as soon as next month or the month after, but I really want the county attorney to do a staff assessment. I doubt very much that he's even talked to the full staff yet, and at least come back to us with where he thinks the resources are currently being allocated. I don't argue with anything anybody said. I have experienced the exact same things. You all know that in terms of the delays and the Supervisor Williams referred to as a point of failure on some issues. But I just don't want to immediately jump to the conclusion that the only way to fix that is through adding an FTE, even though I think it probably is. I would like the guy that we hired to run the office to have a chance to run the office.
Mr. Rogers, can you come up for a second? I have a question for you. And welcome to your third day on the job.
This is first.
No, Mr. Rogers was at the Economic Development Committee meeting where we asked him several questions on Monday night. So this is your second official one. Microphone, please. Microphone.
Rookie mistake.
I have a question for you. If we were to defer the county attorney's piece, or there's an alternate motion to table it to a date certain in December's Finance Committee meeting, do you feel that would be adequate time for you to take stock of this issue and have a recommendation for the committee in December?
No, sir. As I indicated during my interviews with you, I think it's going to take 60 to 90 days to make that type of assessment.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Mr. Williams.
Just in closing, a couple of things I've heard in the commentary and the debate on this discussion was consulting fees. In our six-year CIP, we have $800 million worth of transportation projects. This isn't a spike in transportation projects. If you think that we're going to bring on an attorney for 6 months to help us get it through the hard part, we're going to keep on for 8 years? This is what we ask staff to do. What resources do you need to help projects move smoother, quicker, more efficiently through the system? And they come and they say, guys, this is what we need. And we're like, well, let's think about it. Well, that's fine. This is exactly what we asked them to give us. And I guess I'm not surprised Mr. Roberts didn't want to take an FTE. He wouldn't have to go through getting nitpicked on the project. I hope that, well, you know what? You say that Mr. Rogers has been here for 3 days. And no kidding. But guess what? All these folks, Ben, look across this line. How many years have they been here? It was like the discussion we had where Ben Mays and Tim Hemstry, they come with recommendations, and do we not trust them? These are the experts. This is what they need.
This is the number one item in our strategic plan. All right. All in favor of the three FTEs for DTCI, say aye.
Aye.
Okay, that will pass unanimously. Chairman York absent. All in favor of the two FTEs for Management and Financial Services, say aye. That will pass 3-1-1. Supervisor Reed opposed. Chairman York absent. All in favor of the one FTE for the County Attorney's Office, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
All right, that motion will fail 2-2-1 with Chairman York absent. Thank you. Ms. Rogers, my advice would be put a priority on assessing this and let us know as soon as you feel comfortable in doing so, because my gut, based on dealing with your office, is this is needed.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Reed.
Yes, one of the things that we really need to be taking a look at is the state requirements for the easements and also utility location. As you recall, we had a legislative agenda item to have staff work on traffic lights because there's a lot of red tape there. So I'd be happy to work with you or any other members on, you know, trying to see if we can do something to streamline that.
Mr.
process.
Reed, our problems have not been with the Commonwealth on these easements.
I'm talking about the requirements.
No, it's not those requirements. I know in my personal case at that interchange, I had to personally get involved in the negotiations with two of the HOAs on what they would receive as compensation. That's got nothing to do with the Commonwealth. We had to deal with the compensation for the water runoff with the Conservancy, and that had nothing to do. None of these were state requirements is my point. It's been negotiation between the landowners, compensation, and the county. And then we have to get the deeds. In one case, it was because the HOAs, you know who this is, and I'll say it, Lansdowne's agreement with Openband prohibited them from bringing in other telecom providers into their easements. So we had to take a different approach to that. So none of these were state issues. They were local issues. No. Thank you. All right. Thank you. Let's take just a quick 5 minutes. We'll do the two capital intensity factors, item 12, item 11, and we'll be done. Thank you. Mr. Reed, if you could come join us. Supervisor Williams. Somebody for a quorum, please. Okay, let's start this item out. Mr. Sismar, where did you go to college?
University of Notre Dame.
How'd they do against Northwestern Saturday?
Oh. No comment.
But here's my bigger question, the more important one. What is that tie you're wearing?
I lost a bet to Mr. Davis, so it's a Florida State tie.
Thought that might be it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wore it.
Vote on that?
I wore it reluctantly, but I promised Mr. Hemstreet I would honor the bet. So,
well, don't feel bad. Years ago, the Redskins played the Broncos in the Super Bowl, and I'm a big Redskins fan. My number one team is the Denver Broncos, and after that Super Bowl, I had to wear a hog's nose for a week at work. So I understand. Been there. Okay. Item 12 is Fiscal Impact Committee report recommended 2014. I'm sorry, we're going to, item 12. Recommended 2014 capital intensity factor. Let me just say up front, the Fiscal Impact Committee has been meeting this fall, or is quite a bit this fall. We've wrapped up. I'd like to recognize two members of the committee in the audience, Michael Larkin and Michael Capretti.
We will not be seeking a pay increase.
I'll tell you what, I'll triple your pay. Tomorrow morning, they've been kind enough to ask me to go to NVBIA where this topic is going to be discussed at the bright and early hour of 7:30 in the morning. So with that, I'm not sure who's presenting, Mr. Sismar, Ms. Pastor. And you don't need to take us through everything in here. It's quite extensive. But
correct. The CIF, just as an overview, is the cost to the county to develop capital facilities for new residential units that are approved in the county. So the general equation, like the general overview of the equation, is found on the second page of this item, page 154 in the packet. And generally what we do is we develop cost estimates for every capital facility standard, every facility that has a capital facility standard. We turn that into a per capita cost, and then we use the population generation factors for each type of housing unit to determine the cost of each type of housing unit throughout the county. We also do that for the school facilities. We determine the per student cost for each of the facilities, and then we apply that to each of the types of housing units so that when a rezoning comes in, we have a way to estimate what the cost of the county is to develop capital facilities for each type of housing unit that's approved as part of a rezoning. To get to the heart of the issue, the CIF has gone down from the current adopted CIF. Part of the reason for that is, there's multiple reasons. The county has matured. The CIF was last, as Mr. Bona indicated earlier, it was last updated in 2009. So we've been working with the same CIF for over 5 years now. During that time, the county's developed a lot of facilities. In this past fall, the Fiscal Impact Committee, and then on September 17th, the board adopted a new set of capital facility standards. And some of those facility standards, the requirements have gone down. So what we've actually seen is, with the development of capital facilities throughout the county and the changes to the facility standards, we're meeting a lot of the capital facility standard requirements throughout the county. So the primary change that we made that accounts for the reduction in the value of the 2014 CIF is that we've subtracted out the cost for those facilities where the capital facility standard is being met. Any facility that's currently in operation, either owned or leased, currently under construction, or currently in the six-year CIP, FY15, FY2020, the costs of those facilities were subtracted out of the CIF calculation. So that was the primary reason why the CIF values have gone down compared to what the current adopted CIF is. The primary reason why the costs went down, not only from county facility perspective, when we asked the schools what facilities they still needed to develop outside of the six-year CIP, they indicated it was just elementary schools. So the cost of any middle or high schools that's part of the calculation of the CIF has been subtracted out of the calculation, and that really was the main reason that it dropped so significantly. The only issue with doing
if I can interrupt there, we didn't drop so significantly from the 2009 number. We dropped so significantly from a working number in the middle of our process. Would you agree with that?
Correct.
Okay. Yes. I don't want to give the impression there's a big drop from the 09 number to this proposed 2014 number. It's not. It's rather minor.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Right. I'm trying to remember where I was.
You were talking about the five elementary schools or something.
Yes, thank you. Okay. So the main issue with doing it in this regard where we've subtracted out facilities is if there is a what we've deemed a plan buster, a major rezoning that changes the current plan, it adds a significant amount of residential units to the point where additional middle schools, high schools, or those facilities that we've subtracted out of the calculation would need to come back in. Right now, if this was adopted, those facility kind of costs would not be included as part of the CIF that an application would pay. The Fiscal Impact Committee discussed that, and the main remedy to do that is to follow the revised general plan policy, which states this needs to be updated every 2 years, which was alluded to earlier in this Finance Committee meeting. So the recommendation is if we're on top of it and we're doing it every 2 years, we can keep up with those type of plan buster applications that come in, and we can kind of anticipate what facilities might need to be added back into the CIF. In the instance where a plan buster comes in and we had just updated the CIF, then there might be a reason where staff would have to do a case-by-case analysis. This rezoning application has this type of impact on our delivery facilities, so we would have to do a specific analysis for those types of plan buster applications. But I think that would be few and far between. The comfort level of doing this every 2 years, we think we can stay on top of those instances and stay on top of facilities that might be generated by major rezonings. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay, and let me just thank the committee first. It's a pretty tedious process every single Thursday evening, and I really appreciate it considering that they are all volunteers. Let me ask a procedural question first. The draft motion that's in the packet has the Finance Committee recommend the 2014 capital intensity factor is adopted by the Fiscal Impact Committee and recommend the board adopt that. Yet this is on our public hearing for December 10th. So we have a full board meeting on December 3rd, a full board meeting on December 3rd. So really, if we were to adopt this draft motion, and this is a question, this would not appear on the December 3rd agenda, correct? We would take it straight to the public hearing, at which point, if we so chose, we could suspend the rules.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. Okay, so if this motion were to pass tonight, this will not be on the December 3rd agenda.
Correct.
Okay, I just want to procedurally make sure everybody understood where we were going here. Let me start a little bit because I chair the Fiscal Impact Committee. I'll point out a couple of things. One of the assumptions that the committee has to operate under is that we do have to go by current zoning to include by right, correct? Yes. And why the committee has discussions about, to use your term, Dan, plan buster rezonings, and we had a lot of discussion about them, frankly, the fact is that everything we do is predicated on current zoning, and including by right, because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. So the numbers were based on that. Originally, some numbers went out why the committee was a work in progress. And it took the capital intensity factor, for example, on single-family detached from about $59,000 to about $80,000. But that was a work in progress. And I know a lot in the developer community, you know, they panicked, and probably rightfully so. But the fact is, we still had work to do, and specifically, we had work to do around the schools. So the committee brought in Loudoun County Public Schools twice, and the second time with Mr. Adamo participating remotely after the committee adopted our remote participation rules because of his injury. And what the schools re-verified twice for us was that beyond the CIP, current zoning plus by right required five more schools beyond 2020 CIP, and all five were elementary schools, correct? Okay. Also, the fiscal impact committee, the process had about five changes to it this time versus last time. And one of those changes in particular was that we were going to use five regions instead of three regions in the county. What that meant was it's not an apples to oranges comparison of the 2009 numbers to the 2014 numbers, because you can't map perfectly between three regions and five regions. Another major change in the way we did things was in land values. The land values are now broken out by the five regions, and more importantly, we aren't using assessed values. We're using what we think are market rate values, and there was a lot of discussion in the fiscal impact committee about those market rate values. But that's what we went with. All of this was based upon the capital or the facility standards that we had previously adopted, where we amended some, deleted some, accepted some for what they were worth. But when you put that together with the student generation and cost per pupil, it all yielded this number. And the big driver from that 80,000 number to that 55,000 number was completely the schools. So that's what kind of drove it. The other last thing I'll point out is that you saw in item six tonight that I hadn't inserted that we do this every 2 years. No, worse than every four, but we strive for every two. In my view, having gone from 2009 to 2014 was way too long. It's a burden on the committee. It's, you know, it's difficult. And it, worst case, we have to go through it in every board's term, and ideally we do it twice in every board's term. We could probably simplify a little bit of it. The reason for that, though, is we have to be on top of any anticipated plan buster rezonings and these kinds of things so that we are properly capturing those capital dollars. So I'll leave it at that. Supervisor Williams.
And thank you, Chairman. And let me recognize you. I mean, the leadership you have on the Fiscal Impact Committee, I know, is certainly a time-consuming effort. And I think your leadership on that committee and all the folks, Michael Capretti, Mike Larkin, and all the other Fiscal Impact Committee folks, do really yeoman's work on this committee. And this is the driver to our economic burden. And the reason it resonates with me is because I have about half a dozen plan busters going on in Broad Run. And if we gave everything to everybody they want, we'd have another 30,000 residential units up there in the next 5 years. And that would just crush the infrastructure. And when I try to explain that to people, it helps when I have these numbers. And you can really show people what the numbers and make it work. Now, it doesn't mean we shouldn't strategically, you know, add density where Metro is and where we can help the thing. But I think to make these decisions, and this comes in line with the comprehensive plan amendment that Ms. Pastor is working and her team, and really, if we're going to start modifying the plan from its current way, we need to consider all these things. And I'm starting to appreciate it. So the work that the Fiscal Impact Committee does is really drives so many decisions of us. And I just want to thank you for your leadership and thank the committee for all the hard work they do.
Letourneau.
I have some questions on this. First question is, does every school CIP project include land acquisition? Because some schools have proffered sites.
You're subtracted out.
That's correct. They do have some that are proffered.
Okay. What about those that are not proffered?
Then that is included.
It is included.
Yes.
Is it possible for us to get a breakdown on the CIP numbers?
Well, if I can help there, out of the five elementary schools factored in here, one is proffered. Four require land, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Four require land. The one that I'm most worried about is HS9, which I've been personally...
That's not part of this analysis.
It should be. Why wouldn't it be?
CIP.
HS9's in the CIP, so the cost of that would not have been factored in.
I understand, and that's what I'm questioning. Because I've been involved in land acquisition for HS9, which is not going well, I would say. And the costs are going to be significant. So why wouldn't that be in this factored into this analysis?
Our view of whether to count facilities in the CIP or not, at the end of the day, we came down to we were counting them as already done, because that's the adopt, much like the general plan, the CIP that's adopted is your plan of spending for those capital facilities. So it would be presumptuous of us to say that those numbers are going to be different than are currently adopted by you at this point in time.
Yeah, but you have a project on the last, it's in the last year of the CIP. I mean, it just slipped in. So if the school board hadn't slipped it in, it would have counted in this analysis,
yes,
right?
Sir. That's correct.
Okay. The school board, I mean, it's hard 6 years out to know if they're actually going to build it then or not, and the land acquisition costs are looking like they're going to be higher than anybody thought based on where we've gone. So it seems like we're undercutting ourselves a little bit by taking that strict of an approach to the out years of the CIP.
And if you and the board think that that's true and that should be counted, that's fine, and that things could be recalculated that way. We have to deal, just like with the general plan and zoning, yeah. We have to deal with the documents that you give us and the decisions you've made so
yeah.
far.
No, I understand. It's just that, the board hadn't taken that up as a policy until this is the first time this has come to us, which is a problem. But I'm not quite understanding the logic of why that wouldn't count.
Well, the option was put out there for the Fiscal Impact Committee actually to consider providing some flex in these numbers in the event that this might happen. I think the sense was that, again, we could look at it in 2 years and maybe have a better sense of what we needed to do to make that change as opposed to doing it right now.
Well, I think there's a second part of that. We can't crystal ball if something's going to cost more or less than what's in the CIP. But that land acquisition is built into the CIP, and that's why the Fiscal Impact Committee did not try to second guess and know that it might be something different than what we're projecting out of several years in the CIP. It's already been incorporated. Whether it's right or wrong, it's in there.
Yeah, I think I'm not so much questioning that. I'm more questioning why we wouldn't calculate and why we wouldn't factor into the calculation for what we're charging CIP projects. I mean, those that are already built and under construction and funded, I understand. But those that we haven't even acquired the land yet and would certainly are seeing an increased demand for because of development. And if we were to have a rezoning in this area, would absolutely be probably in this area and be impacted. Don't get that logic.
And it goes back to what Ben said, that you could do that, and we could recalculate it.
Right. Okay, that's one question.
But hang on. If we had to recalculate it, that means we would have to pro forma out those costs out of the CIP in order – I'm not saying take them out of the CIP, but pro forma them out of the CIP in order to do this calculation, because otherwise you'd be double counting it.
Well, you wouldn't be necessarily double counting, but you could, as a policy decision – decide the first 3 years, for example, of the CIP are hard and fast, because that's true. The first 3 years are generally hard and fast. And that the last 3 years, you're going forward, always going to roll into your total inventory of future needs. So it really is a policy choice. You wouldn't have to make those other decisions financially at this point. But again, we approached it that we have an adopted document from the Board of Supervisors, and that, so that's our steady state. But again, it's a policy choice for you all.
Okay. The next question is, just to clear something up, Dr. Adamo and Julie and I, we had this conversation. Dr. Adamo told me that when he did these projections, he included only by right projects that were active or that he had some inclination that would develop, but that he did not include every possible by right actually developing by right residential for his enrollment numbers.
We confirmed with him that I was right, that he did include the fact that there were other by right would happen. But what he was saying is it's not going to generate the need for additional elementary schools, that given the age cohort analysis and the way that they project how they would backfill these schools, it would not trip a new school.
So if every possible by right project parcel developed to its fullest by right potential, it wouldn't change anything for their enrollment.
That's correct. That's what he said.
Okay. Let me get finally to what looked like it was a somewhat controversial discussion in the Fiscal Impact Committee. It had a 5-4 vote, which is impressive, and that was the reduction of land values for school sites by 25% in the Dulles Planning subarea. Mr. Sizemore, can you explain what your argument was to the Fiscal Impact Committee, which apparently was unsuccessful?
The CIF in the Dulles area, four of the elementary schools are in the Dulles area. The CIF wouldn't charge for four elementary schools. If you have a new unit, the children in that unit are only going to go to one elementary school, so you're only charging for one elementary school. The vote was to reduce the land values in the Dulles area by 25% because one of the four sites was proffered. I think I unsuccessfully tried to argue, you don't really need to do that. We're only charging for one school, not all four. So, you know, you would have land acquisition costs on the other three schools, so we should have the full land acquisition value as part of the CIF. But the vote was 5-4, so we reduced in the Dulles area the land acquisition for that the schools by 25% because one of the sites was proffered.
But if the site is proffered, then that expense isn't there.
Correct.
So what's your argument?
We're not charging for four schools in the CIF.
We're only charging.
We're only charging each unit for one school.
But the amount, the total amount is less because one school's already provided.
And that was the majority opinion of the committee. Philosophically, you can argue it both ways, and I think we actually did that day. And the committee did break down, as we said, as you said, 5-4 on that issue. I think there are strong arguments in both directions.
Okay. I'm not sure you really moved me in any direction, though.
it was a pretty detailed discussion on it. And I want to point out, I don't vote on the committee, okay, because I vote later. But the fact is, I think the argument was pretty good both ways. It has no substantial – you got to look at the big picture. It has no substantial impact really at all on these numbers.
Well, the only thing is the Dulles area, I would argue, contrary to what you said earlier, is seeing a significant decrease in the 2009 number. I mean, it's like 20%. And that's where most of the growth in the county is going to be. So I'm having a hard time getting my head around that.
It's mainly because of land values.
And it's also because it's land values, and it's also because the middle schools and high schools are out of it. That's the, you know.
Well, and I think that gets back to the first point and the first question that I made, that I had about
The schools are quite adamant that after the CIP period, they're not building any more. They don't see a need to have to build any more middle schools and high schools.
But, see, that's not the point, because what we're talking about is if we do bust the plan. I mean, by definition, what we're doing by looking at these numbers are coming up with what the cost would be if we go over what was planned. So by definition, yeah, I understand they're saying they wouldn't build anymore. But if we start approving a bunch of rezonings, then they would build more. And then the question is, what do we charge for them? What is the appropriate amount?
Well, then we have to figure out exactly, during the scenario of a rezoning, and it comes in and it trips the need for a complete new school because it's so big.
Right.
Or if you do an area plan like the Silver Line discussion and it trips the need for multiple new schools, we have got to recalculate the CIF.
Right. But
yes, you can.
You can.
You absolutely can.
Well, all right. That's what if somebody comes in on January 1 and files an application to do that for 3,000 units in Dulles South, I happen to know of one who may be very well doing that. They're going to be under these numbers. I don't care if we in 2 years are going to look at it again. They're still going to be under these numbers.
Number one, they're probably not, because it'll take at least the period of time to get through the rezoning process. They would have to get to that. And during
Wait a minute. We have been charging folks what the number would be when they first file.
No.
We don't.
No.
It's when they get to the
Planning Commission.
Okay.
And the other thing is that I really probably should have said this earlier. I think Dan alluded to it. This number is a proxy for a new resident. What is it going to cost for a new residential unit? And it isn't really that far off in the sense of what it was in 2009. The other point I wanted to make was that you have a sub-area map now.
Yeah.
Some of your Dulles is in Ashburn.
Yeah.
And so you have to really look at that map to make sure that,
right.
you know, so you are getting the number that is much closer to what you need.
Mr. Letourneau, if I can add in, the concerns you have are exactly the same concerns Julie and I had as we went through this process. We looked at the 80,000 number and said, well, that doesn't make sense. We had to change our view of the whole world at this point. We have, up until this point in time, we had considered a house was a house was a house. Wherever it was built in the county, it had the same effect no matter what, because we were growing and our future was growing, you know, and there wasn't really, you know, an end in sight. But the reality is now, the reality on the ground is now, especially in parts of the suburban area, that we're pretty close to full build out under the current zoning and planning. And we did not think we could just ignore that fact, that we're not going to build that many more regional parks. We're, you know, and there is a practical limit as even how many more high schools and middle schools. So we changed, really, this new CIF is a real sea change in philosophy from where we've been in the past. But at that same time, the three of us had the discussion that everybody has to understand that this new CIF, while it's reduced in many cases, significantly reduced, as you said, in the Dulles area, but not significantly reduced in the other part, that it is only good for applications that fall within the current plan.
Right.
You know, if you're really looking at something that's not part of the plan, then staff's going to recommend to you at that point in time that we do some kind of secondary analysis to see what the true capital facility impact, if that is.
I just have not seen that in any. We've not done that. We've got applications coming
for us to build.
Well, we have 900 units coming for it in the next 3 months. And
we have never done this before. This is a new world and a new approach.
We didn't make a change in our fiscal policy to tell staff to go recalculate the cost of units every time we have a large rezoning.
No, but
I'm sure our friends in the development committee would not like that very much.
Sorry. But we did look at what is the net impact. So when we get a referral from schools that says we are going to need, you know, this is going to generate X number of kids and this number of seats in these schools, there is nothing preventing the board from saying that's a full school. That's a school that's not here. Now, the question is how far it tips it over. Is it just a, you know, is it an infill project? Is it just minor situation? If it's 900 units, or if it's a waterside, or if it's any of those that although waterside will presumably maybe be under the old numbers, we'll see. But
you give us that analysis.
We do give you that analysis. And
yeah, I just don't think anybody really pays attention to it.
Of course. Well,
but that's another problem.
Not
everybody. Certain members of the board don't.
Mr. Reed's been trying to get in here for a long time. Mr. Reed.
Thank you. The Leesburg area, you're referring to the JLMA. Is that just the JLMA, or does it also include?
No.
What is it?
Everything in that
planning
box
area. Mm-hmm. So that would include Lansdowne?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, where's the map? Lansdowne's in, I believe, in Lansdowne is in the Ashburn.
It's in Ashburn.
It's up to the creek.
Lansdowne's in Ashburn. It goes to Goose Creek.
Okay, it goes
to
Goose Creek.
Your last page. This
we
is
normally consult. Do we normally consult with any of the town planning people to see what they think?
Absolutely.
Of it?
Absolutely, they are part of. They have been part of the projections.
Okay.
I mean,
yes.
The Fiscal Impact Committee has been meeting for a year.
So the
or
town
more.
Of Leesburg did have some. So the town of Leesburg has had some. They have knowledge of these statistics and so forth.
Yes, and they also they collect capital facilities, and presumably they give them to us.
Yeah,
for
I know.
Things like
the pass through, the good old ADAP pass through, which some of us don't think still has to be done. But I support these guidelines. I will send it to public hearing, see what happens there, and that's what we're doing here. I think that if any of my colleagues have any issues here, they should, like Mr. Letourneau's doing, raise them. We got some time on this. You guys did a great job. I want to thank you again, Mr. Chairman, for your leadership here. And as I said, I'm prepared to send these forward. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to move that the Finance, Government Service and Operations Committee recommend the 2014 capital intensity factor is adopted by the Fiscal Impact Committee and recommend that the Board of Supervisors adopt the 2014 capital intensity factor.
Seconded
by Supervisor Reed. Again, we're recommending it be adopted, but it has to, by law, go to public hearing, which it will do on December 10th. One thing I did tell the Fiscal Impact Committee in our very last meeting was that whatever motion I made would be what they voted for, that I wasn't going to change anything when it came here. If the board wants to change something, they can. I felt that the committee did its work. I felt that they debated these issues diligently, that they were very serious about it. I think staff did a fantastic job in presenting options to us, and I wasn't going to modify what the committee came up with. They're all citizens, they're very smart people, and they work very hard at it. Mr. Delgadio.
Thank you. I agree with the fact that you do a lot of work and that you're meeting
so many times as meetings I don't have to go to. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And to the members of the Fiscal Impact Committee in doing all that work as at such little pay. I wanted to ask, I kind of understand that the shift 3 years of the first CIP being firm and then the second, third, the next 3 years of the six-year CIP kind of being soft. So how would we frame that policy recommendation that the second 3 years be included in the CIF? Would that be at the public hearing or would it be at a board meeting?
You would do it at whenever you're prepared to adopt the item.
So if we're going to a hearing, the committee votes on this, and the board votes December 3rd, but we have a public hearing on December 10th, and if there is public comment, and then if we want the second portion of the CIP to be considered in the CIF, would that slow you guys down, or would we have to come back to another?
We would definitely have to bring it back to you.
I see.
But how the process would work would be, you know, if that evening of the public hearing, if the board were to move to suspend the rules and consider adopting the thing at that point, if whatever actions you took at that point would be whatever actions you take, and if you changed it, we would have to go back and bring it back to you, or you could adopt it that night.
Now, my second question, or my final question is, we had a very long process in the Finance Committee as well as the board meeting where we adjusted some of the plans in the CIP, and one of them was a horse park or something, a horse facility, and we took it in and took it out, and it was a whole bunch of stuff. There was about 50 items altogether in terms of what it was, what it isn't, and we took those. Is all of that included in this CIF?
Yes, sir. It represents the stuff that Dan brought to you earlier.
How long ago was that? Was that 3 months ago?
September.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and after we did that, and we did take the equestrian park out. I made the motion to take it out.
That's right.
But the fact of it is that what we did approve in September as a Board of Supervisors, then we then had to take that piece back to the Fiscal Impact Committee and do the rest of the steps of the process. And
I just wanted to put on the record the amount of work that goes into this topic is mind-numbing and detail-oriented. And
I'm not questioning them.
The board is absolutely behind you all the way in spending the time that you've been spending. Thank you.
I will point out that the reductions are not substantial, and when Supervisor Letourneau says, well, Dulles went way down, that's not apples to oranges. We went from 3 regions to 5 regions. It's not an easy comparison. But as Supervisor Reed said to me, this is a small reduction based on science, on math. It's not a reduction based on just, whatever the board feels like it ought to be. This is a very mathematical, deliberated process that finally hits a holy grail after 2 years of work to spit out the CIF. So that's where we are today. I do want to say to staff, if you remember earlier this year, we got a lot of VACO awards, including the Academy Award for Best Picture for the libraries. I really think we ought to nominate this process for a VACO award. I think this is an incredible process. It's very meticulous. It's very methodical. I'll go. But I don't think any other jurisdiction does anything like this that I'm aware of, and I think that this is a beyond a best practice, and I think somebody ought to take the initiative and nominate this for a VACO award.
But will you go to the Jefferson Baths, though, with me? That's the question. I don't know if you do that.
So I think you get my point. I think we should nominate this. So, all right, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 302. Supervisor Letourneau and Chairman York absent. Okay, last item, capital intensity factor and profit policy considerations for age-restricted and continuing care retirement communities. Folks, this is a information item, but that said, I think it needs some action, so I will be making a motion on this item. The Fiscal Impact Committee, I think it was Supervisor Williams that kind of initiated this. When the board looked at the Walton Wood application, we realized that the capital intensity factor may not fit well for certain types of age-restricted or independent living, or, you know, there's a wide continuum from just age-restricted all the way down to what I call continuous care and lots of things in between. And some of them are corporate and some of them are residential, and there's a whole mix in these things. And so based on that Walton Wood discussion and the fact that what Walton Wood paid as far as a impact fee was very different than what some of the previous applications to it paid. We had to have the discussion of, well, should the board maybe create a policy regarding these types of communities? My personal view is we do need some kind of policy. It's case by case right now, but it certainly isn't consistent. And I think that the development community at least appreciates certainty. It's like the stock market. It hates uncertainty. But if you know, then you can factor those numbers into the economics of a project and with certainty that that's what it's going to be instead of trying to negotiate it. Tonight, it came for information. I'll let staff say whatever they want to say on this, and then I'll finish with a motion. Okay. Julie?
The one thing I do want to say is in terms of consistency, and of course, you've reiterated how much work has gone into this process, and it is substantial. But the fact of the matter is when the staff gets an application, even if it's for a continuing care or an age-restricted type of facility, we calculate the full impacts. So you always see that in your applications. It will just, we would use the CIF just like we normally would, because those units in that facility, whether they are, like I say, in a continuing care facility or whether they're in an age-restricted that has multiple different types of units in it, we would spell it out the same. The difference has always been, and I believe it was probably in the 90s at some point, the late 90s, where we really concluded that maybe we should acknowledge that there are different impacts associated with those units that do not generate children, because the school part of the CIF is such a big component of it. But up until that point, there was the feeling that just because, you know, you might not have children, you know, you should probably pay the full impact. If you're going to buy a new unit, the impact is still the same, no matter what. So we always presented in all of our applications that bottom line number. But we did, when we updated the CIF, and again, it was in 99, and then in 2004, and then 2009, we began to kind of try to segment out, at least to get rid of that school component. And in return, we were looking for applications that were of this nature to commit to the fact that they were going to have over 55. So we required proffers. The PDAAAR zoning district, for instance, requires a commitment that they will not be market rate, or they will not be, not for just general population age-wise. So there, we were comfortable with that. So you can see reflected in the table that up through that time frame, by and large, age-restricted or continuing care facilities were pretty upfront with, we will pay the non-school CIF. And again, the staff continued to say, here's the full impact, but the board was very comfortable usually in accepting, you know, just the non-school impact. Then we started getting a little bit nuanced in that regard. And as Mr. Bona indicated, I would say, started moving in a more case-by-case basis, and we started, assisted living and nursing components of continuing care, you know, they're not mobile. You know, people are not moving out of their, moving around their facilities and, going to the library, or, you know, they're pretty much bound. So maybe we could, you know, subtract them out too and just deal with the independent living units. And then, as you indicated, then we had Walton Wood. And Walton Wood was a departure on all accounts in the sense that it didn't do anything. It didn't do the full non-school for independent units, and it didn't do anything really. It basically, for lack of a better term, it kind of cherry-picked various components of the CIF, which drives these guys crazy because, you know, when you're doing really a fiscal impact, you don't usually get down to this is what fire and rescue, when you're doing a per capita kind of assessment. So that one really did kind of throw us, and you had the foresight to say, wait a minute, we're doing this, but we really need to look at it.
I think you told me to do that, Julie.
I did. I probably did. And I wanted to start this whole thing by saying I've done the Vulcan mind meld with these guys here so that when I leave, there'll still be some legacy here. And, of course, we still have these guys here too. So I'm hopeful that if you do direct us to go forward and kind of look more detailed on this item, which I think is where you're going, Supervisor Bona, that can be done. I think we lay out some issues for you that are a little bit, might affect your consistency situation, because there are continuing care facilities allowed in various zoning districts by special exception. And as you've heard all along, we do not negotiate proffers with special exceptions. We only do conditions. And the only thing we've done historically is fire and rescue in special exceptions. Ben can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think back in 2005, we actually, the Fiscal Impact Committee suggested looking at commercial properties and should we assess capital facilities for commercial facilities, like fire and rescue and sheriff and things like that. So there's a whole host of ways you could go here. I don't want to cloud the issue with the continuing care and age restricted, but I think you're going to have to take that into account and maybe just accept that you're not ever going to capture the full freight on this. You're going to capture, a reasonable impact that is potentially generated by these facilities. One last thing I would say is that actually it shocked me, the conversation at the Fiscal Impact Committee, because I think the comment, and Mike Larkin, are you still here? He basically said that he bought a new unit in Loudoun County and he doesn't have any children in schools, but so why should he have to pay the full freight that the CIF generated for his unit as opposed to somebody who's living at Ashby Ponds? So that was kind of where they were coming from, was they were fully supportive, and I think for the reasons you indicated, that they want a level playing field. That is what the hallmark of the proffer process is, that people know we are not a regulation. The plan is a guide. It's not a regulation, but it gives that sense of a level playing field, and that's what we're looking for.
Right. In order for the Fiscal Impact Committee didn't get as far with this as maybe we wanted to, but the fact is we had to get to the capital intensity factor, and we would have had to met for another 3 or 4 months every single week if we were going to get there, and the committee worked so hard I didn't want to put them through that, so I recommended. And so the Fiscal Impact Committee agreed, let's take it straight to the Finance Committee and have this discussion. I think what's important is you don't want to cherry pick, and you can't ask anybody that doesn't have kids, don't pay the schools and vice versa. I mean, that is the nature of why we pay taxes. But there are some things that these facilities don't avail themselves to, but there's some they might avail themselves to more. Here's a good example of fire and rescue. Does one of these kinds of communities call 911 more than an average community? And I'm going to bet they do. I mean, I've been in Leisure World. It's in my district. Yes, they do. Okay. So you have to take those kinds of things into account, too. But I said earlier, there's a continuum from just in Ashby Ponds, an age restricted over here, all the way to what I would call nursing home or continuing care or whatever. And there's a spectrum in between. And maybe there's different numbers for each one. You're right, we won't capture it all. Special exceptions don't apply. But I would like to get to a policy that has consistency. So, Mr. Reed, do you have questions, or can I make a motion first?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just a statement. I wanted to hand these out that my aide found. It was the Spotsylvania County requirements where they say that I'm just going to hand this out for your edification. That's all. I'm not going to have a discussion of it. Please take a copy. Okay, thank you. That we're doing this. So thank you, Mr. Williams, for your leadership.
Yeah, and the bottom line is that in Spotsylvania, they do have age-restricted and non-age-restricted calculations. That's the bottom line.
Mr. Chairman.
Let me get a motion on the table, and then we'll go from there. I'm going to move that the Finance, Government Service and Operations Committee recommend to the full Board of Supervisors that we add to our strategic plan an evaluation of capital facility impacts for age-restricted through continuing care retirement communities and their fiscal impacts. Seconded by Supervisor Williams. I'm not sure that needs much discussion, but this was an info item, but I felt if we didn't take an action in here tonight, then what was the purpose of having this item? So I think we need to take an action. We'll get in the strategic plan, get it queued up, and get to work on this. Anybody else? Just Mr. Delgadio.
Thank you. That's a good start, Mr. Chairman and colleagues. The question I have for staff is now, I have some age-restricted homes in Sterling, as all of us do. I've been to them, and I have seen that there's a discussion at the developer level or at the owner level, the management level, that they view this determination by the county to deal with the technical term, a majority of the house, of the homes, of the residents need to be 55 and up. And in some of these developments, they've allowed children. So that would totally throw this out. So I want to know if you're aware of that and if that on the record will help the chairman to include that in his motion to these exceptions to the situation that are existing. Or I just would like staff feedback so that we actually know about this.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, Mr. Delgado, and I think there's one that goes along with that. And I don't think I need to amend the motion, but this is something staff has to address, especially when it's mixed units like you bring up. And there's also, in my view, if they want relief from these capital intensity fees, then they have to put it age-restricted in perpetuity. This is not a three-year and then it opens up type of deal. I mean, if you're going to get that break, then we're not going to start putting kids in those things that need schools 3-5 years down the road. Julia, you want to comment on?
No, that's exactly. I mean, it is in the item under the issues section. We did say, I mean, currently a development project does not need to provide to contain 100% 55 and over. But we, in the, if you rezone to PD AAAR, you must put the covenant that must be in the proffers and committed to. We could do the same thing and require that in all, again, during a rezoning. Now, if it, under the special exception, we wouldn't be able to do that, but you're going to get an application pretty soon. I think it's called Wildwood, the Wildwood Farms application. And that has been an issue that we have brought forward to that applicant to say there is nothing in here to prevent exactly what you're saying, Mr. Delgado, that it couldn't convert or that couldn't have, you know, kids in the unit, grandparents taking care of kids or whatever.
Can we require that as a covenant?
Well, we've asked the applicant to address that issue, and that will come forward as an outstanding issue.
And I'll further amend my motion to ask staff to account for both of those issues when you look at this analysis, both what Supervisor DeGaudio raised and what I raised. Okay. Other Supervisor Williams.
Just real quick, I appreciate staff for bringing this to our issue. I mean, as we try, I'm sure all of us deal with, you know, the market that we have currently, and seeing the tone of this board, which has not been receptive to converting and bringing additional residential online, despite the, you know, 30,000 plus of residential units in the queue, you know, we're trying to work with developers. We're trying to find out if there is things they can do that won't have such a burden on the community. And one thing that people picked up on probably a year and a half into our term is, well, hey, would you be amenable to, you know, senior communities? And they do put less of a burden on the system. But I'll tell you this, the over 55 section I've got at Van Meter over off in Braldens, there's that bus stops there in the morning. So I'm not quite sure if those covenants exist there. That being said, I appreciate the analysis. We want to do it, but we also don't, you know, I wouldn't necessarily support cutting taxes for all seniors either. But is there a reality to the fact that there's less burden on the community? Absolutely. But then again, that when I get to be 55, I'll still be paying full freight, and there'll be people that have five kids in the schools, and that's just kind of the process. And what I would say to Mr. Larkin is, you're too young. You're not getting a break yet, sir. That's right.
That's right.
Well, that'll be our next. If we go too far down this path, Chairman, we'll be picking and choosing which families have to pay which capital impact fees. But that would probably be a big thick exercise there. But be supportive of the motion. I appreciate you bringing it, and appreciate you guys taking a look at it and us trying to get some consistency. That's going to be the problem. Ashby Ponce is going to say, well, why? Because that's how the way we based really the Waltonwood discussion was kind of starting from Ashby Ponce. And as you pointed out, it was so significantly different what we were requiring of them than we did for other communities. So once that shift came about, you certainly let us know that if you guys are going to start looking at these significantly different, be consistent. And otherwise, we put ourselves, I think, potentially at risk. So, no, I agree with having the discussion and appreciate Fiscal Impact Committee taking a look at it.
Thank you. Thank you. And just in closing, I'll point out that Supervisor DeGaudio, Supervisor Reed, and myself all passed 55, and we're all paying full freight. So we can't fix the past, but we can create certainty for the future, and that's what this item is really about. We do know we're going to see several of these come into this board and the next board and maybe the board after that. The development community, number one, does see the aging of the population in place in Loudoun County to a degree, and also the fact that this board is Council Trent to rezoning commercial to residential. I think the development community sees this as a product that is a viable product for them, and therefore, at the same time, I think their concern about should we pay full freight is a very valid concern. So with that, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. So opposed? Okay, motion carries 302. Chairman York and Supervisor LaTourneur absent. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, December 9th at 5 p.m., Supervisor Williams. Dan, nice tie, and with that, we are adjourned. Nice tie, and with that, we are adjourned.